Well, the story is told in Jewish folklore that on one occasion four Jewish mystics, those people who had devoted themselves to the exalted state of being, were able to ascend to heaven. And after they'd been there for a while, one of them went mad, another became a heretic, another one died, and just one rabbi, Rabbi Akiba, returned home in his right mind. That little story reminds me of this story of the Transfiguration that we've just had read for us. It's a fascinating story. In that Jewish folklore, only one of four overcame or coped with the ordeal of the confrontation with the throne of God. The story of the Transfiguration is set in a context in Matthew's Gospel where the disciples are trying to figure out who Jesus is. Who is this guy? In fact, just before this story, the question has been raised by Jesus himself. Who do you think I am? Who do other people say that this, the Son of Man, is? And I suspect that one of the things that arose from them as they were on this Mount of Transfiguration was perhaps that sense of, we have no idea. And it's very easy for them to have walked away as heretics or as madmen. So the story is simple. Jesus takes these three followers of his, Peter and James and John, and they ascend a mountain. And as they reach the summit of that mountain, suddenly the appearance of Jesus is transformed. His face shines like the sun, and his clothes are bleached as white as they can be. In fact, Mark tells us no bleach on earth could bleach them as white as the clothes that he appeared to be wearing. And as they peered into that brightness, two other people appeared, one Moses, another Elijah, in conversation with Jesus. And then suddenly a cloud descends on the mountain, and from the cloud comes this voice, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Well, Peter and James and John are terrified, and they cover their faces. And then moments later, when they open their eyes again, Jesus is standing alone. Moses and Elijah have left, and the cloud has disappeared. Now, in light of that experience, who then is Jesus? Who is this one called the Son of Man? Of course, the disciples are bewildered and confused. You have this little incident in the middle of that story where Peter says, "Oh, this is great. Why don't we settle here? I'll build you a little house, each one of you. All three of you can stay. Moses and Elijah and Jesus can stay here on the mount." Rather a confused and bewildered kind of response. The story of the Transfiguration kind of plays on our imagination. It's kind of enticing us into something that we don't usually experience in our daily lives. What does it actually mean? What sense can we make of this story against that question, who then is the Son of Man? Who then is Jesus? How on earth is it possible that men who died many, many years ago, Moses and Elijah, can suddenly appear on the mountain? How do clouds have voices? Questions that we really can't answer. Well, the testimony of the Bible is that God is present on earth. He moves amongst us, and we don't always know his presence, because no one has ever seen God, no one has ever really understood God, no one can see God, the Bible tells us, and live. So, this morning I want to just point out a few little features of this story and then ask a big question. We obviously struggle with the notion. Our sense of history is that once you're dead, you're dead. So there are complications with this story of Moses and Elijah turning up in this story. But what I suggest may be indicated by that particular feature of the story is that Jesus stands in the line of Moses and Elijah. He is a continuation of that ancient tradition. And we're to understand that that's the case. Here's a little clue of who Jesus is. Reaching back to that moment when the children of Israel were given the law in the desert of Sinai, and of course the many traditions of the prophets that were recorded for us in the Old Testament, somehow or other this transfiguring moment for Jesus is an indication that we're witnessing something that stands alongside of that ancient heritage. Secondly, the words that come from the cloud are an affirmation of who Jesus is. These words are actually a repetition of what was said at Jesus' baptism. Behold, my beloved, my son, the one in whom I am well pleased. So there's a sense in which we're hearing that the authority that Christ carries is not his own, but is recognized by God himself. And we're told to listen to him. Well, thirdly, although neither Peter, James, or John went mad or became a heretic, they were bewildered and confused. And I want to spend a bit of time thinking about this. Mark tells us that Peter didn't know what to say because they were so afraid of the experience that they had had. And that decision to build a few little shelters for the for Moses and Elijah and Jesus are a rather a silly reaction from somebody who knows they've got to do something but doesn't know what to do. And clearly the voice that comes from the cloud overshadows that, and we lose that particular train of the story. Because this was an experience they'd never had before, and they were bewildered and uncertain and confused, there is a lovely sense in which as they walk back down the mountain, Jesus doesn't berate them, he doesn't correct them, he doesn't tell them off. He rather lovingly accepts them in their bewilderment and confusion. And he actually says to them, you know, the best thing right now is don't say anything about this because you don't understand it. You won't understand it until more of my story is unfolded. So don't try to explain it to anybody. Just keep it to yourself for the moment. And that's perhaps a warning for a lot of us who have moments when we glimpse something of who God is and then chatter about it. And often what we're doing is babbling about something we don't really understand. Peter, you see, later, and that came in the story, in the first reading that we had this morning, he reflects back on this incident. Now some years have passed, and he's thinking about what might have happened on that Mount of Transfiguration. And he kind of recalls it in his writing as if it happened yesterday. We ourselves, he says, heard this very voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. And then he goes on to connect that word that they heard from the cloud to the prophetic tradition. And he's saying, you do well to listen to that prophetic voice. And then it's almost as if he kind of catches himself and remembers that warning of Jesus to be careful about what you say about these things. Because he then goes on and says, be careful. Don't rely on your own interpretation. Private interpretation of these kind of things is dangerous. And the next chapter, which of course we haven't read, he goes on in some detail about the kind of things that happen, how people so easily deceive themselves. They follow cleverly devised myths. It's a long description of false prophets who offer their own interpretations of what it means for God to be present in our world. He calls them destructive heresies. They're waterless springs, he says. They speak loud boasts of folly. They promise freedom, but they are themselves slaves. And then he says, and this is a rather unkind word to say about anybody, but Peter's quite clear. When you privately interpret your own experiences of God, these are the dangers, he said. The dog returns to its own vomit, and the sow, after washing itself, returns to wallow in the mire. So be careful about what you may attempt to explain of those moments when you do have an encounter with God. And it's a warning to all who have the temptation to explain their experience when they themselves are confused. Well, what can we say about this story or from this story that might help us to answer that question? Who then do you say that the Son of Man is? Now that phrase, Son of Man, occurs frequently in the Gospels. It doesn't occur anywhere else in the New Testament. 87 times, I understand, this phrase is used, and almost every time it is on the lips of Jesus. No one else calls Jesus the Son of Man. Only Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. It's very interesting that when the churches got together, and we'll be moving into a discussion around the creeds coming, starting next week, when the church councils got together in the early years of the church to try to sort out who is Jesus, they never used this phrase, the Son of Man. And yet it's the phrase Jesus used of himself continually. A rather interesting omission, it would seem to me. What does that phrase, the Son of Man, mean? Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a confusing, grammatically confusing explanation of that phrase, because the way it's translated into English, the Son of Man, is not really an accurate translation. The Greek has two definite articles in that phrase. It actually reads, the Son of the Man. Now, that's a strange kind of way of self-identifying. Jesus is saying, I am the Son of the Man. That's a strange kind of saying. What does it actually mean, and what sense might we make of it? Well, I don't have time to go into all of the details of this, but if you dig back into the Old Testament, the phrase, the Son of Man, does occur occasionally in the Old Testament. One particular example perhaps gives us a little sense of what's going on here. When Ezekiel has his first vision at the beginning of that book of Ezekiel, he is actually aware, going into the presence of God, of this. The opening vision, he sees God as appearing as something like a human form. And it seems that what is going on here is that God is presenting himself to Israel in human form, as the man. And that perhaps is a hint as to what Jesus is trying to associate himself with. In the line of Moses and the prophets, he is saying, I am the Son of the Man. I am the Son of the one who reveals himself in human form. See, informing man of the dust of the earth in the likeness and image of God, somehow or other, God is incarnating himself in human form. And Jesus shows us what that actually really means. I am the Son of the Man. I am God incarnate, is what that sense, that story is telling us. Now, this has importance for you and I, because we are called to follow Christ, to deny ourselves and to become like Christ, to take on the mind of Christ, to put on the mind of Christ. So that there's a calling deep in our faith to become like Christ. That is to become fully human as he was. What does it mean for that to happen? My sense is that actually most of us, in fact I'd say all of us because I certainly include myself, really don't know what it means to be human. We struggle a little bit, and we kind of manage to cope with life. We are kind of shaped by our circumstances and the situations in which we live. We've taken on board the answers to the questions we asked our parents. We're kind of bewitched by the messages of the advertisers. We're beguiled by the words of the politicians. We have this sense of what it means to be human, not because we are fully human, but because we have adopted a way of being that we've learned from our heritage, our family, and from those around us. We've kind of sold out to a truncated self. We live like miniature humans, miniaturized. We're not fully human. There's so much more potential in us than we have realized. And when we're called to follow the Son of the Man, called to follow Christ, we are called to become more fully human. That's quite challenging. So in those moments, perhaps when we're on the mountain and something stirs within us, deep within us, and we're faced with something we can't quite fully explain or understand, but that intrigues us, we are being offered a little glimpse of what it means to be fully human in the presence of God, surrounded by those who are in our heritage and history. And we are led to strain forwards towards that which we can or might become. You see, the Bible tells us we're not what we are, what we should be. We fall short of the glory of God. Paul, in his letter to the Philippians, says this, I strain forward towards what lies ahead, pressing on towards the goal of the prize of the upward calling of God in Christ Jesus. And it's a calling to be more fully human as he was fully human. Now clearly we can't do this on our own. The Americans have a little phrase, I don't know if you've heard it, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. We can't do it that way. That's a sort of a phrase that has become sort of characteristic of people who, through their own efforts, can actually achieve what they want to achieve. We can't do that. We can't be fully human on our own. We need not only to listen to the words of Jesus, but to rely upon him, trust him, put our full faith in him as we seek to follow him. And the process of doing that is about denying that little miniaturized, truncated selves that we think give us our identity in order to be open to the expansiveness of what it means to truly be fully human. I've almost said enough, haven't I? The goal of human life is actually not to become something that we cannot be. Some Christians sometimes think that our goal is to become divine. That was the mistake Adam made. You remember when Adam took of the fruit of the tree that he should not have taken? God said, they're becoming like one of us. Our calling is to be fully human, to be all that we have potentially within us as we are awake to the light of God that is within us, and we let that be the driving force, the influence upon our lives. We are called to become what we have the potential to be, which is fully human. We are not the creator. We are creatures. John writes this. What we will be, we have not yet seen. But we will be like him, because we will then see him as he truly is. We will become like the one who called himself the Son of the Man, God in human flesh, incarnate in human flesh. It was Irenaeus, the second century bishop of Lyon, who said this: the glory of God is the human being who is fully alive. That is our calling. Amen.